From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, here's the news for this day in Maine, Wednesday, October 21st, 2015. I'm Andrew Catalina, in for Barbara Caridi. On this day, MaineCare's ride service is again under scrutiny after costing the state more than expected. A study reveals that the Maine lottery disproportionately affects the poor in a way that critics say is effectively a tax, and a new book takes a snapshot of identical twin boys from Maine and their family, except one doesn't feel like a boy at all. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible in part by listeners like you and by Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of MPBN Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
I'm Andrew Catalina. MaineCare's transportation system is coming under fire after state documents revealed that its budget ballooned by $5.5 million this past fiscal year. The program has already faced criticism after being overhauled by the Department of Health and Human Services a few years ago. But, as Patty White reports, DHHS officials say the extra money is needed to solve past problems.
The transportation program provides MaineCare recipients with rides to healthcare appointments. According to a recent newsletter by the State Office of Fiscal and Program Review, the service cost the state about $45 million during the last fiscal year. But the budget has since increased by 12%. To more than $50 million.
We are extremely pleased with the performance of this transportation system that is truly responsive to the needs of Medicaid, MaineCare members.
Mary Mayhew is commissioner for the Department of Health and Human Services. She says the transportation program costs more because over the past few years, it's expanded service to nights and weekends.
We would certainly expect that increased volume would lead to increased expenditures within the program.
The state changed its MaineCare transportation system in 2013, at a point when community agencies scheduled and provided rides. The federal government had raised concerns about the lack of state oversight, and DHHS decided to move to a managed care model, where transportation brokers are paid based on the number of MaineCare recipients they serve versus the number of rides they provide.
But one of the advantages of going to any kind of a managed care model is that it is supposed to interject predictability and stability.
Drew Gattine is a Democratic representative from Westbrook and co-chair of the legislature's Health and Human Services Committee.
So it appears that what we have here is the worst of both worlds. We've had a system that has provided service that by all accounts has not been as good as the previous service, and it's actually ended up costing the taxpayers more.
The switch to the new transportation system in 2013 did get off to a rocky start. MaineCare recipients complained that the major broker at the time, Coordinated Transportation Services, caused them to arrive late to appointments or miss them altogether. Currently, the largest broker in the state is Atlanta-based LogistiCare. Jack Comart of Maine Equal Justice Partners says there's been a positive change.
It's an improvement over a year ago, but there have been some recent issues that clients have brought to our attention.
Issues such as clients getting dropped off for appointments but not being picked up, or vehicles that aren't equipped with car seats for children. Comart says there have always been issues with various transportation providers, and the state shouldn't necessarily ditch LogistiCare as long as the company can meet performance standards and respond to complaints. But he points out,
well, we've layered on this brokerage system, and LogistiCare is a for-profit, and I think one of the others is a for-profit, and so it's more costly to do it this way.
But according to DHHS Commissioner Mary Mayhew, the increased cost is translating into better service. MaineCare quality metrics provided by DHHS for January through September of this year show that all of the state's eight regions have a complaint rate of less than 1%.
I find some of the questions and inquiries about this interesting, given that we spent 2 years talking about this transportation system and certainly responding to concerns that were being raised.
Representative Drew Gattine says the Health and Human Services Committee will likely take up the issue in an upcoming meeting. He says he's concerned that lawmakers weren't notified earlier about the extra expense.
So it's going to cost taxpayers $5 or $6 million more a year. I don't really understand why that wasn't flagged for us during our budget discussions.
Meanwhile, Jack Comart of Maine Equal Justice Partners says any Maine Care recipients who have complaints about transportation should notify Maine Care Member Services. Comart says the department has taken action on cases brought to its attention. For MPBN News, I'm Patty White.
The Maine Department of Education has tentatively picked a new company to administer next year's state achievement test online. The company, Measured Progress Incorporated out of New Hampshire, ran into computer glitches in several states last spring, but says the bugs won't reemerge here in Maine. Jay Field reports.
Martin Borg, Measured Progress's CEO, says those states were all using the same test.
The Smarter Balanced Open Source System.
In North Dakota, Montana, and Nevada, Measured Progress was a subcontractor that administered the Smarter Balanced test. But there were problems. In August, Measured Progress agreed to pay the state of Nevada $1.3 million after server failures and other technical issues marred the state's first year of online testing. Montana and North Dakota faced similar problems. So did Maine. It's a big reason why the legislature severed the state's contract with Smarter Balanced. Borg says he's confident Maine won't experience the same kind of problems next spring because Measured Progress is using a different system, one called eMetric.
They've been used in Oklahoma and New Mexico, and we've had an utterly reliable experience and a long and trusted relationship with that organization.
In selecting a new test provider, the Maine Department of Education required all bidders to disclose any problems they've had with contracts in other states. Charlene Tucker is the department's head of assessment and accountability.
On our review team, we had a technology expert, and he sort of helped us sort through the issues that folks described in their proposals and their implications for us.
Tucker says she's confident that testing will go better next spring, now that Smarter Balanced is no longer in the picture. But like last year, Maine's new test will be an online exam. And that continues to worry some educators.
If they're starting from scratch to do an online test this late in the season, that's late to do.
Lois Kilby Chesley is president of the Maine Education Association, the union representing the state's public school teachers. She says last spring's problems, unclear instructions, crashing computers, and lost work, were disruptive and difficult for students and teachers.
We have some concerns that that might happen again. So, we're trying to make sure, we're trying to look into it now before we put our support behind this Measured Progress test to make sure that we really have a lot of answers to the questions that we have.
Those companies that bid unsuccessfully for the Maine contract have 15 days to appeal the state's decision. Education officials, meantime, still have to negotiate the details of a final contract with Measured Progress. For MPBN News, I'm Jay Field.
Shelley Pingree, a U.S. representative from Maine's 1st District, announced today that she is looking to attack food waste. Pingree says she will introduce comprehensive legislation this fall to reform the way sell-by or best-by dates are used in labeling the recommended shelf life of products.
The statistics are just staggering. 40% of all the food in the United States is wasted. And that's about 20 pounds of food per person. And if you have 50 million people in America who are going hungry, if you would reduce the amount of food we waste by about 15%, we could feed half the hungry people.
Pingree says many restaurants, institutions, consumers, and agricultural producers mistakenly think there is some sort of government standard for Best Buy dates and that food has to be tossed out once the date is passed. She says instead, food manufacturers recommend the dates in full knowledge that the food is safe to eat long after the label says so. Pingree announced the bill at the Food for Tomorrow conference hosted by the New York Times. A proposal to cut the number of scallop fishing days along the southern Maine coast has been approved. The proposal drops the number of scalloping days in the southern Maine zone from 70 to 60. A state advisory council charged with ruling on the proposal voted unanimously in its favor Tuesday. The Midcoast and Eastern Maine Zone, which stretches from Penobscot Bay to Lubeck, stays at 70 days. The Down East Zone, comprising the scallop-rich Cobscook Bay and the mouth of the St. Croix River, remains at 50 days. Scallop fishing starts in December and ends in April. A Maine natural gas utility has been ordered to inspect and potentially replace pipe fittings that may have been incorrectly installed on gas lines in 7 communities. The Morning Sentinel reports that the order, issued by the Maine Public Utilities Commission earlier this month, requires Summit Natural Gas of Maine to check more than 600 electrofusion couplings in cities along their transmission line. The couplings, if found to be faulty, could heighten the chance of gas leaks. Matthew Capley, a spokesman for the company, says it will focus its efforts on Augusta and Waterville in areas that have a large concentration of customers. PUC officials believe the faulty equipment was installed by 3 subcontractors in 2013 and 2014. Officials with AARP, homeless advocates, and others joined in a press conference this morning to air concerns about a proposal to limit development in Portland. They say the move will put affordable housing further out of reach in the city, which already faces high rents and low supply. Tom Porter has more.
Question 2 on this November's municipal ballot seeks to amend the current land use ordinance to protect certain scenic views. Supporters say the measure was drawn up out of concern that Portland councillors give developers too much of a free hand. Dana Totman is president of Avesta Housing, a non-profit developer of affordable accommodation which opposes the measure. Speaking in front of a project under construction on Munjoy Hill, Totman said there's a critical shortage of affordable housing in Portland.
Unfortunately, there are 2,500 people still on our waiting list. We want to build more housing for them.
But Totman says that may not be possible because question 2 creates another hurdle to the development of affordable housing. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
A new bus route was announced today connecting Lewiston and Auburn with Portland. Governor Paul LePage joined state and local officials at a press conference in Auburn to welcome the announcement. The service, which is expected to be offered by Concord Coach Lines late next year, will start at Bates College in Lewiston, stop at 2 new bus stations in Auburn, and then finish at the Portland Transportation Center, with connections all the way to Boston. A one-way ticket to Boston will cost $50. Henry Blunt is president of Concord Coach Lines.
Our best assessment is that somewhere in the 50 to 75,000 passengers a year range should be what we should be expecting here if we build our service. One thing comes with the other. You don't get that kind of ridership without providing a level of service. And what I mean by that is a frequency of service that becomes a viable option for people.
Details are still being worked out, but Blunt says plans call for 5 or 6 daily trips between Lewiston, Auburn, and Portland. Buying a scratch ticket can be an occasional, fun thing to do, but as an investigative series reveals, some Mainers can sink a whole paycheck on the lottery. And the poorer you are, the more you're likely to spend. The differences aren't small either. The people who live in Maine's poorest towns spend as much as 200 times per person more than people in wealthier communities. Dave Sherwood, writing for the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting, suggests in his series that lottery games are designed to appeal most to those who can least afford to play them, resulting in what he describes as a, quote, multi-million-dollar tax on the poor. The center's editor-in-chief, John Christie, says the series is based on a statistical analysis of lottery users along with Maine numbers and census data, and shines a light on some disturbing trends.
We went to this store in Waite, population 101, because in our research, we discovered this was the town where it has the highest per capita spending of any town in Maine, and it's also one of the poorest towns. The per capita spending there is $1,313 for every man, woman, and child in town, according to the financial statements that we've got from the state. And that contrasts, for example, to places like Cape Elizabeth, where the average, where obviously there's much greater wealth, where the average person spends $25 per year on tickets or less. We discovered that every time there's a 1% increase in joblessness in a given zip code, that the sales of lottery tickets jump 10%. The people will come in and they'll have spent the whole day going from one store to the next, I guess, thinking they can increase their chances to spend $200 or $300 in a day on lottery tickets. In other cases, people come in and basically buy their whole paycheck in lottery tickets. There's a case where someone came in and they bought some groceries and a bunch of lottery tickets. And when there wasn't enough money to buy all the groceries and all the lottery tickets, they took the milk and put it back in the freezer.
You say the lottery pretty much operates as an independent business. Can you explain to me the sort of nuts and bolts of how that works?
Yes, well, the lottery is run by a division of the state, and it is run under state law, but it doesn't get a whole lot of scrutiny from the legislature. And the legislative committees could provide more scrutiny, but it's not their habit to do so. As a very well-known legislator, former legislator, told us, who was there for many years, he said, this state is drunk on this revenue. It brings in $230 million a year is the total revenue brought in by the Lottery Commission through sales of tickets. And of that, $50 to $52 million is, quote, kind of profit. And that money goes into the state treasury and represents about 1.5% of the state's annual spending. And the state, and people are raising, occasionally do people raise questions about the lottery, but the response generally is, that, well, we've got this $50 million coming in every year, and if we don't have a lottery system, where are we going to get the money? And then the whole issue sort of gets put way, 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 way back in the what people care about.
Inevitably, some people are going to say, well, this is a voluntary thing, and these people are just, they're just stupid. How do you respond to that?
Well, it is a voluntary thing. I wouldn't object to that description. But I think the issue that we're raising here and that some of the legislators we spoke to are raising is an ethical one. And I'll go back to how this began. In 1973, the lottery was instituted, and they had some projections on how much money they would make, and they weren't bringing those projections in. They discovered in the beginning that Mainers were not really all that excited about a lottery. We have, at least going back to that period of time, a reputation as a flinty, frugal state. And people weren't buying lottery tickets at the amount expected. So what did the state do? Instead of accepting the fact that voluntarily this is what was being spent, they put in an advertising campaign. The point of the advertising campaign is to entice you, like any advertising campaign, to do something you wouldn't naturally do, to buy something you weren't intending to buy. So not only does the state run a lottery, it spends millions and millions of dollars every year to entice you to be the barker in front of the carnival tent to say, come in over here and get rich quick, be a millionaire, buy a yacht. So voluntary, sure, but how much is anything voluntary when you've got a sophisticated advertising campaign pushing you to buy these tickets and promising you things that probably aren't going to be delivered for most people? Most people are losers in the lottery. Very few people are winners. But if you look at the advertising campaign, it looks like everybody's a winner. You never see a picture of a loser.
John Christie is the editor-in-chief of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. John, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Dave Sherwood's series can be found on news.mpbn.net. Last year, Nicole Maines won a lawsuit before the Maine Supreme Court that set the precedent for a transgender child to choose which school bathroom they prefer to use. But behind that front page news is the story of a Maine family raising identical twins and coming to grips with the fact that one of them does not feel at all like a boy. A new book, Becoming Nicole, also chronicles the way in which the family fought for their daughter's rights. Jennifer Rooks spoke with the book's author, Amy Ellis Nutt, and with Wayne Maines, Nicole's father, about their journey.
I think the biggest reason is, yeah, I bared my soul to a whole lot of people. I know that, and I think that's how we demystify things and help people grow. I mean, everybody has challenges in life, and everybody makes mistakes, and I've learned so much from my children and my wife and the people that we've met that helped us on this journey, that I hope that me being open and honest about that will help them grow too. It was a little hard to read the first 4 or 5 chapters, even though I've seen it a number of times. You know, it's personal, and I had to put it down a couple times.
Your book, the story, recounts the journey of an American family. I'm wondering, Amy, if you went through a journey of your own, did you know as much, did you understand as much about transgender children as you do now?
No, I absolutely did not. And yes, it was a marvelous journey. I even read a book about the history of mermaids, just because I was fascinated by that metaphor being so prominent, especially with male to female children. So I learned a tremendous amount. And, you know, I reflected back on the fact that when I was in college, and I took my course in the psychology of sex roles, Dr. John Money at Johns Hopkins was basically sort of the preeminent voice for behaviorism, which has been largely discredited, including, you know, some of his work. He pioneered, you know, the transgender issue in a lot of ways, but he saw that as being, as gender being something that could simply be trained into someone. And obviously we've discovered that's not the case. So this was a marvelous chance at educating myself, and it was a fascinating journey.
Back in 2011, MPBN's Susan Sharon interviewed both Nicole and Jonas. At the time, they were in middle school and going what they called stealth. Wayne, you'd moved to a new city, Portland, and the family at that point had decided not to tell any other kids or parents that Nicole was transgender. I'm going to play two pieces of sound from that interview. First, here is Nicole 4.5 years ago talking about herself.
I don't think I ever thought of myself as a boy. The thought of me being a boy just kind of makes me cringe. I couldn't do it. That's how I rolled. I was like, yeah, I'm a girl. I don't think I could be a boy.
And here's her identical twin brother, Jonas.
What's your biggest fear?
That something tragic might happen to my sister, you know. I always fear extremists. And so I always fear the worst, which I'm sure I don't need to name. It would be too hard to name it. But I always fear the worst might happen.
Do you talk about that with her?
No, I don't.
Wayne, what's your reaction hearing those interviews today?
It's hard. Yeah, it was a tough time. They were 13 years old. You can see the difference in their personalities. Nicole, with a strong front and positive, and ready to take on the world, and Jonas, you know, worry. You know, those are tough times, and you asked me, you know, why did we do this book? Because there's families all over going through those tough times. But I'm also extremely proud of my children. They learned that they have powerful voices at 13 years old. They learned that children can change the world. And, you know, Nicole walked around our state house and talked to representative after representative, and they listened. You know, I'm extremely proud of our leaders in the state of Maine for doing the right thing. But man, at the time, it was really scary.
Wayne Maines, the father of Nicole Maines, and Amy Ellis Nutt, the author of Becoming Nicole, The Transformation of an American Family, were guests on MPBN's Maine Calling. To listen to the full program, visit mainecalling.net. And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, October 21st, 2015. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to Patty White, Jay Field, Nora Flaherty, Jennifer Rooks, A.J. Higgins, and Tom Porter for their contributions to the program. I'm Andrew Catalina. For all of us here at MPBN News, thanks for listening.